Today, we're talking about recent changes in employment law and what they mean to the banking world. I'm your host, Honey Shelton, and this is Training Matters.
Training Matters is brought to you by the Training Institute, dedicated to setting the standard for individuals responsible for training effectiveness in banks and credit unions across the country.
Our guest today is Steve Green. Steve is an expert in the field of employment law and specializes in working with banks and credit unions. Steve, so glad to have you on the show. Welcome. Before we dive into some juicy topics, please tell us about yourself.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. So I am and have been a management employment lawyer for about 30 years. And my firm, all of us support community banks and credit unions in employment compliance matters and really focus on that activity. Obviously, those industries have been really impacted with new obligations or more burdensome obligations over the past 2 years, 2.5 years. So we are very much engaged on those items and very happy to participate in the show and hopefully provide some guidance that would be timely for the listeners. So thank you again, Honey, for inviting us to participate.
Steve, employment law matters are always a topic of interest, but the buzz seems to be focused on changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Please share with us what's going on in that arena.
Absolutely. So the Federal Department of Labor has made significant changes to the overtime exemption tests under that Fair Labor Standards Act. And those changes go into effect December 1 of 2016. They will limit the individuals employed by banks and credit unions who can be exempted from overtime payment obligations. So this is really a big deal, and it's really adversely affected the financial industry significantly. The two key changes are these: that in order for anyone to qualify for the most common overtime exemptions, the salary level has been increased from a little bit over $23,000 a year salary up to a new standard of $47,476 per year salary. So the compensation level required for exempt status has more than doubled, and that impacts who we can treat as exempt going forward starting December 1 of this year. The agency also changed the scope of what they refer to as the highly compensated exemption. And this exemption standard has moved from an annual compensation level of $100,000 per year now to an annual compensation level of a little bit more than $134,000 per year. So those two changes to the overtime exemption standards are causing banks and credit unions to have to reevaluate where their people stand and look at options in terms of changes to how we're treating current exempt people, alternative pay plans, all sorts of restructuring issues. So while we have been working on that, and the industry has, since the just about the middle of the year, the activity is definitely picking up as people look to that December 1 effective date.
Well, you certainly zeroed in on a dramatic change in how the rules on overtime will play out starting December 1st. The impact on the budget, structuring who does what, staffing solutions, lots of things to ponder. What will be the consequences for not being in compliance? What's the penalty, and how big will that penalty be?
So in terms of compliance, compliance is policed two ways. One is by the Department of Labor that does conduct investigations of employers generally, banks and credit unions certainly, when there is a complaint brought to the Department of Labor's attention. So part of the policing comes from the federal agency itself. However, most of the policing comes from private plaintiff's lawyers, where those private plaintiff's lawyers can go ahead and bring actions in federal court against banks and credit unions enforcing these new overtime exemption standards. So those are the two areas of vulnerability. Now, in terms of the consequences, when we treat an employee as exempt, when we don't pay overtime to an individual who works more than 40 hours in a week, then the burden is on the organization to prove that an exemption applies. And if we are unable to prove the exemption applies, then the liability is the unpaid overtime compensation that the individual should have received. And that is calculated at time and a half the individual's effective hourly rate of pay for all hours worked. It gets a bit complicated in terms of how that liability is calculated, but the liability goes back up to a period of 3 years. So we can be held liable for unpaid overtime for a 3-year period. And secondly, if the action is brought in federal court, the court will typically award an equal sum in what they call liquidated damages. So the consequences of being in non-compliance are up to 3 years back wage liability for the impacted employees, and typically they go after more than one, and an equal sum to those back wages. And another consequence is, in the event of private litigation, we also become liable to not only pay the bank or the credit union's attorney's fees, but also to pay the attorney's fees incurred by the plaintiff's lawyer who sued us in the first place, which just obviously adds insult to injury. So the financial consequences in these cases tend to be very, very substantial.
That is attention getting. It's clear to me that anyone who's involved in running a business, but especially a bank or a credit union, must have on their bifocals and be standing at attention, wanting to know more about how to comply with these changes and, of course, do things right. Steve, you talked about wages and overtime compensation. What do you see happening with minimum wage?
Yes, in terms of minimum wage, it certainly has been a very, very hot topic for a number of years. And at the state and local level, we're seeing a good deal of activity and also a fair amount of proposal action, where different states and municipalities are moving to increase their minimum wage levels, and some pretty dramatically, up to $12 an hour or $15 an hour. So we're definitely seeing that activity, but it really depends upon your immediate market and local area. At the federal level, there's certainly been some discussion about increasing the minimum wage under the Fair Labor Standards Act for a number of years. There has been no progress on that. There are, many organizations and interests that oppose an increase in the minimum wage. And given a number of things causing paralysis in Washington, it's probably unlikely that anything's going to happen when it comes to the minimum wage level for the foreseeable future. That at least is again, at a federal level. But locally, big deal, something that we definitely need to keep our eye on. And some of those local laws are really very, very disruptive. Another item here is that obviously in the banking industry, While sometimes our base rates, base salary, base hourly rates are lower than some other industries in the immediate market, in the banking and credit union industry, we tend to have much richer benefits. And unfortunately, that's not really being taken into account here.
I can certainly tell from our discussion that your clients must appreciate being able to turn to your firm for guidance around cost forecasting and budgeting in that payroll arena. Is that a valid point, Steve?
It definitely is. And I'm not sure that the government, state or local or federal, necessarily weigh this very heavily, but these costs, the costs of exempt status, increasing people's salary, or having to begin paying people overtime compensation where they haven't been paid overtime compensation in the past, or increasing minimum wage rates, those are significant cost items for the financial services industry. And we're in a tight market as it is in terms of our cost structure. So in terms of budgeting, in terms of alternative compliance approaches, alternative compensation approaches, new ways of thinking about staffing our organizations, that is a major area of activity now and will likely be an action item for the foreseeable future.
Steve, I feel like you were reading my mind. A lot of HR managers we work with and the executive teams we talk to must also be looking at alternatives in terms of employee leasing, if that's still out there, or part-timing some positions or some other ways to deal with the impact of these changes. Certainly thought-provoking. Let's shift our attention a little. I want to talk about a topic that pops up a lot in workshops that Interaction Training does. Several states have legalized the use and distribution of marijuana. So the question that comes up is, what happens if an employee comes to work under the influence? How do you handle that?
Yeah, another very good question. I would caution the banks and credit unions to go ahead and look at their own local laws, primarily state laws here, because there is some variation. But the bulk of those laws do, as you indicated, allow for the use and distribution of marijuana, but they do not impact the employer's right, be it a bank or a credit union, to go ahead and manage employee conduct on the premises during working time. Those are two separate things. And to the extent that an employee comes to work impaired, that the organization absolutely can take adverse action up to including discharge. That just because a state allows for recreational use of marijuana doesn't mean that employers have to tolerate that behavior when it crosses into the workplace or working time. And that includes even people who are under the influence of alcohol. I know that goes a little bit beyond your marijuana question, but it's related just to the general issue of substance abuse. So we can take corrective action. We need to take corrective action. And those laws, by and large, allow us to do so. We get into a lot of shades of gray here, where, for example, someone may not be impaired by marijuana, but they may smell of marijuana use, and that smell can be inconsistent with what we want the employees to, their relationship to us, either as a bank or a credit union, customers, coworkers, and the like. So you get into some odd scenarios too, but generally speaking, we absolutely can discipline someone who comes to work under the influence of marijuana, even in those states where the consumption is lawful.
Great feedback for our audience on that topic, Steve. You know, it's always challenging to address an issue with an employee that you know or suspect is under the influence. I want to move over now to another topic of concern for managers, and that has to do with interviewing candidates. Share with us some insight on what to do and what not to do when it comes to asking questions in an interview.
Right. Well, a couple of thoughts. First is, generally speaking, in terms of our employment interviews, when we're looking at candidates, it really does make sense, and a lot of times we don't do it, but it really does make sense to definitely plan for the interview and to go ahead and have questions written out and prepared in advance so that as you are interacting with the individual, that you've already got your game plan in mind in terms of the specific questions, the order of questions, and the thoroughness of those questions. What that also does by having a script is it allows you to be somewhat consistent from one interview to another, because ultimately what we're doing is we're eliciting information, but we're also comparing candidates. And by having the questions laid out in advance and consistently going through them from one candidate to another, that better equips us to compare and contrast information that's shared from the applicant. And sort of in terms of the questions to stay away from, which also it's easier to manage that by preparing the questions in advance, but it's any question that directly or indirectly goes to whether the individual is in any of these federal or state protected classifications. So any questions going to, for example, children, marriage, child care arrangements, all of those questions go to either marital status discrimination, which is prohibited in many states, or sex discrimination, which is prohibited federally as well as in many states. So those are certainly questions that we need to very much stay clear of. The issue of religious affiliation, religious practices, is also something that we need to be very sensitive to. In the case of religious discrimination, we need to avoid asking questions which elicit information regarding someone's religious beliefs. But in that area, we also have actually a federal obligation to accommodate religious practices of applicants and employees. So that's another area where we definitely need to be sensitive. And then the third and final would be in the disability area. Questions regarding the individual's impairments or medical conditions or medical history. Now, there are some questions we can ask when it comes to whether the person is physically capable of performing the applied for position. But when it comes to these questions that can get into disabled status, we do have to be very careful in terms of how we frame the question. There are certain inquiries that are permissible under the ADA, and there's some that are viewed as too far afield. So those would be the three interview areas where we have to be particularly sensitive in the banking or credit union environment.
This certainly has been enlightening. No doubt our listeners appreciate getting a current perspective from an expert and insight on these big changes. If they want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? Share with us what your company does and what you can do for our listeners.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. So Employment Law Compliance is the name of our company, Employment Law Compliance. And you can get additional information by going to our website at www.employlawcompliance.com. And we were formed 15 years ago. We only support community banks and credit unions, and we only support them in the employment compliance area. At this point, we provide annual support to approximately 600 banks and credit unions. So in terms of being focused on this industry, that is definitely where we are we are focused. We tend to be a product company as opposed to a consulting company. And we develop products that have widespread distribution in the industry. Affirmative action plans are our most popular offering. The federal regulators have come out with a new diversity standard obligation. We certainly have a product coming out in that area. We developed the overtime exemption toolkit to address the first issue we talked about in this conversation. So that's our world, is employment compliance for banks and credit unions. And again, really, really appreciate the time with you, honey. And look forward to maybe doing some more of these presentations in the future.
Thanks again, Steve. I'm going to go on your website right now and check out your toolkit. I think it'll be extremely helpful. I know our listeners will want to look into the toolkit as well. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you enjoy Training Matters, subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite platform, and don't forget to share the show with those that'll benefit from it. Tune in next month and join me for another episode of Training Matters.
You've been listening to Training Matters with Honey Shelton.